Starting to type here.
Well, you can start that by asking the question.
People in the cell that you first began with, what did they do normally in their daily lives?
What anybody else would do. Mariette, I think, was just finishing school, or had just finished school. Fudoff had a little farm. The old man, Van Eekhout, was retired. I never met Mariette's father. But these people all had their whatever job they were doing, they had it the same as anybody else. This was all extracurricular. You did in the evenings or whenever you had free time, depending on what you did. And the resistance isn't just a specific function, or a resistance worker, a specific form of endeavor. There was a great variety of situations. For example, it gets known that the Gestapo is looking for somebody, break into his house in the middle of the night, and he's lucky he wasn't there that night. Well, he knows he's been fingered by the Gestapo, so he's not going home. All right, they had a group attached fairly closely to the group I speak of called the Wittebrigade, which was northern Belgium, and I suppose the Dutch were the same, and whether they interlapped, hard to say. I wouldn't know, certainly. But these people had to go underground totally because they were wanted. So they couldn't work or do anything. They were in hiding. And one of the terrorist groups I worked for had a food depository in the factory, piston ring factory, half a block from the front door of the Fabrique Nationale in Herstal, Liège. And cases and cases and cases of canned peas and other staples as well, and anything they could get, butter, and all heisted in one form or another. They used to rob the post office periodically to get ration stamps, and then finally the ration system go all to pieces and they have to reprint new ration stamps, and there was just a constant battle all the time to feed these people. But those that had gone underground and were still operating, they lived in semi-hiding, and but they could still function. They just couldn't report to a given job at a given time, because it would only be a question of the Gestapo going and knocking on the door where they work and taking them. So that is one phase of it. The other is, of course, the people that are not known to be in the resistance, and they're able to carry on as if they weren't. You didn't run into the partisan type of thing. I'm thinking of Yugoslavs, where the countryside was such that you could hide a whole army in the hills and never find them. Belgium and Holland and most of France was a country that had been well established and for generations, several centuries really. And you weren't fighting in the mountains, because there aren't any, and that sort of thing simply couldn't come to pass in those areas. Norway was different. The Yugoslav situation's another one. Even in Denmark, you couldn't do that. But a friend of mine was on the second Altmark raid and succeeded in getting into Switzerland. A very cunning concept, the whole thing was. But the other organization that I worked with, which was a smaller one that was locally headed, and I stayed with the man that was ahead of it, was strictly terrorist. And he's the fellow that owned the piston ring factory. He did not survive the war. he got taken in a raid one night with the Gestapo came. I was with the other two airmen, the American and Englishman, across a house across the street when that raid took place, and the Gestapo came for both houses. And you'd think that people like that would be sophisticated enough to know to cover the back door. And it was just, well, it would be sometime in early daylight, I would say maybe 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, which is unlike them. They usually struck a little earlier in the black. But first we knew of it, I was up. I was just getting dressed, and these other two fellows were still in bed. And the apartment belonged to Madame Legrand, who subsequently moved to the U.S., but she had a store, meat market, down below, and she also was a bit of a delicatessen as well in peacetime, but she didn't have much to delicatess with in those days. But she had a big coffee roaster they used to roast wheat in, delicious drink. Anyhow, the Gestapo came barging in well before store opening hours, and Felix and his wife, who ran the little store and had a suite down below, I guess he had seen the Gestapo going in across the street at Lucien's place, and before they came to our place, he came running up and saying the Gestapo was raiding Dupre's, and that only took me 2 seconds. I went out of the second-story window into a little courtyard, concrete floor, and boy, it makes my toes tingle, curl right now, thinking of landing in the cement and my sock feet. But Felix and his wife, I've forgotten her name, had a little dog. They used to keep it in that little enclosure, so there was more to it than just jumping out. You had to miss what you weren't aiming for. Anyway, the three of us got out of there, went out the back gate, the little courtyard, and fortunately, in this instance, there was a road there. So a lot of these European houses, the back gardens butt together, and there is no lane, or you don't go right on through, that you just butt into somebody else's house, which would have been bad news, because at no time, even in peacetime, do you leave your doors unlocked. We'd have had to break a window to get through if we could have found one. You know, this type of thing would have been very, very marginal. However, it was just an open the gate in the back stone wall, and we were out, and we did know of a house, because we used to circulate in the streets quite a lot. And we knew of a safe house a short distance from there, and we were in the front door, out the back door. I've forgotten the sequences now, but somewhere along the line, after we'd gone through this house, we got picked up on the other side by one of the resistance workers, and he knew what was up, just from the expression on our faces, because this is old hat. They've seen a lot of this before. And we went down into the cellar of another house in the coal bin, and we just stayed there until, around 11 o'clock that night. And then it would have been just before curfew. Leave us just enough time to legally take the tram. And then we went down to a place, Herstal's, the north of Liège, and this place was down in the just about south-central Liège. I visited the place this summer. It was kind of interesting to walk back and have a look at the old building and a little bit of a boulevard out in front where we could... it's getting into winter now. And after supper, we could go out and get out and get some fresh air. Things were getting pretty tight then. Didn't take too many chances. Although the woman that we stayed with there, who's still alive, getting forgetful, but she was just a going concern. She spoke German fluently, Walloon, French, and Flemish, and all these languages as a native. She would go into the Citadel, which was the big civilian prison, and a big one. There was also Gestapo headquarters in Liège, and deliver food parcels and that sort of thing for people in there whose family didn't dare show their faces around the place. And she was on first-name terms with the CO. And one day she asked Ron and me if we would like to go with her to visit the Citadel. And Ron's the Englishman. And I said, well, I'll pass. Ron says, sure, I'll go. I said, you're out of your mind. You're walking right into the lion's mouth like that. He said, she said, no problem. I know the old guy. He won't give you any trouble. Well, Ron's description of it when he came home, he said, that's a little bit shaking. He said, I don't think I'll do that again. I said, okay. They evidently went into the waiting room, and there's one of these low wooden rails that they had between where the office workers are that used to be so popular years ago, and a little gate in the middle. Well, there was a long lineup waiting for people to go and get a pass number and all this sort of stuff to visit their relatives. But not Madame Joanneau. She walks up, opens the gate, walks in, and said, I want to see the CO. And this is my nephew from the Zuider Zee or someplace, who's just visiting me for a day or two. Goes in and introduces him to the CO. And she says he doesn't speak Flemish or German. And no, he only speaks Flemish. He doesn't speak German or French. And the CO, the Jerry commandant, turned to him and said, you don't speak French, in French. And Ron says, and I just said no, instead of looking dumb. Well, I guess it's the sort of thing. That's one expression you know. Parlez-vous français? So the guy says no. Anyway, he had more brass than I've got. And such a quiet little guy, too. It surprised me.
Can we just, maybe you could tell us how you linked up with Ron and this other guy, because somehow we've skipped from where...
I've skipped around a lot.
Can we maybe go back with you to the Louis in the very first few days that you...
The sequence. I you get a little point and it takes you to one side too easily.
That's fine, but I just don't want to lose track of your story.
All right, well, when I got to Turnhout, and this is after that fateful little stop and talking to Fruithof in the garden, we went on up to Turnhout, and I stayed with a fellow by the name of Eugene Bakermans. He was a young man, 30, lived with his widowed mother. They were upper middle class people, I would think. Took me up to an upstairs room, and while he didn't lock my door, I sensed he locked the door in the hall. And I didn't object, because I thought myself, well, he's obviously going to make sure that I'm not going to do anything drastic or that I am not something I'm not supposed to be. And he told me, he said, we're checking on you. I said, how do you do that? He said, never mind. So I said, okay, I won't.
Couldn't you have shown him an idea?
That doesn't necessarily mean anything. All they got to do is find Bob Masters lying in a bog somewhere and take his ID card and his tag tags, put him on some likely-looking counterpart, and away we go. No, that's too easy. He said, we're going to radio through to London. He said, how we do that is none of your business. I said, that's fine. And I got fed. Oh, gee, she was a good cook, and sure, it was sparse, but I made that note in there.
You remember
years ago that the food was really a delight. Mind you, these people, once they accepted you as being what you represented yourself to be, in my case, a Canadian airman, they couldn't do enough. They simply couldn't. And when I was over there this last time, I said, I have to thank you so much for what you did for me during the war. And they said, you keep forgetting that that's what you were doing for us. And I never quite thought of it like that, but I suppose it was true. Anyhow, I spent 3 days with Eugene Bakerman's, and then he took me over to another house nearby, family of three, Albert Soten and his wife and young son, just baby. I visited the baby this summer. His dad's dead, unfortunately, and his mother. But I stayed there for around 10 days before we got this thing organized enough to get my false passport identification card and civilian one, Belgian civilian. And then we took a tram from Turnhout. Electric train into Antwerp, anyway. No, tram into Antwerp, electric train down to Brussels. Got it. And they were very, very careful in the traveling. I did not sit with any of my contact people. I was introduced to a fellow in a house. This is the man you're going to be dealing with. And you will get on the tram, several people away from him. Keep your eye on him. Don't get too close to him. And when you get to this train station in Antwerp, you will be passed on to another man. You'll know him because he's going to go up and ask him for a match. The guy he asks for a match is the guy you follow. And being super careful, and he said, your ticket? Oh, it'll be passed to me, and you know, very carefully, you pick up a magazine and this sort of thing. It sounds a little melodramatic, a little bit like Russian spy stuff and that, but it was effective, because if you don't have any reason to suspect somebody, then somebody drops something and picks it up, you pay no attention to it, but or ask for a light. And the same drill applied going down on the train from Brussels. I had a Flemish or French magazine, Signal, German publication, wartime, something like Life in the States. Interesting, lots of pictures. You don't have too much trouble being absorbed. If it's all printing, of course, you could hold it upside down by mistake. So I browsed through this magazine and arrived in Brussels, was taken to the house of a fellow by the name of Powells. And I stayed with him for 3 days. And I learned my first French lesson, idiomatically speaking. I hadn't had a smoke for 4 days, and my tongue was hanging out. And this fellow Powell chain-smoked. He pulled out a package of cigarettes, and he handed me, or offered the package to me, and I said, oh, merci. Well, that means no thanks. If you want something, you say please. Don't say thanks. And so I said, thanks. And he put them away again before I get my hand on one. Well, I didn't have the gall to to say, hey, hang on a minute. So anyhow, but he was relatively high up, I suspect, in this organization, quite high up. And their main objective at that time was to get me back to England. And I suspect, and did at the time, that in the structure of this resistance movement, that the head people had different areas of responsibility, presumably. One was looking after the certain types of sabotage and maybe other things, but one of them would be the trying to return airmen had been shot down. And I suspect that Powell was probably on the executive. So I was, from there I went to stay with some women, an old lady and her daughter who worked for the Red Cross. And I was there for several days. I've got notes on that here too, but I won't bother to look them up now. But I think maybe 5 or 6 days, I suppose. And a woman came and said, I've made arrangements for you to stay in another house. And she was introduced to me as Marguerite Bulpa. And I spoke to her this summer, too. She's still alive, not too well. She was 35, and I was 21. And we got along like a house of fire. I had the biggest crush on her I've had on anybody for a long time. Beautiful woman. And we used to take long walks in the woods and all sorts of idyllic adventures. But she married a fellow with a rather stuffed shirt. And can you believe when I went back in 1960? Now, I knew this girl's sister, two sisters, brother-in-law, mother, other immediate family friends. And I went back there in 1960, and her old man was such a pompous ass, he would not allow her to join any of the festivities they were given because the silly old fathead. Which I was rather disappointed because she was such a remarkable person. Anyway, I stayed with these people, and I got moved between two or three families because you can't stay too long in any one place.
When you stayed with these people, did you stay holed up inside the house?
Yeah.
Or did you kind of go out? You just mentioned that you went for walks with this.
Oh, yeah, well, that would be in the evening. Okay, well, then later on, as my French was starting to pick up and I wasn't having too much trouble, then we found that it was necessary for me to go somewhere. It's better to go in a crowd than it is sneaking out the last streetcar before curfew and this kind of thing. And as I say, I was getting by quite comfortably as far as being out in the crowds were concerned. And but I didn't do any active work with them up to this point. And I was staying with the Margarita's sister and brother-in-law, the Stenchens, at another part of Brussels. And it was when I was there that I got word they were going to move me south. And I went to a little town of Enghien on the Belgian border, France. And I was there for several days. Now, the details of this are a little foggy. I can go through these things here and clean up dates and people.
Well, maybe what you could do is before we get together next time,
right,
refresh your memory with
that. I didn't. I was starting to read them last night, yeah, and I got carried away on something else and didn't do it. But at any rate, that was when I got word that the previous group going through had been blown away on the station platform in Paris, so I had to come back to Brussels. Back to the same people, and all the goodbyes had to be gone through again. Hey, crazy. Anyhow, I can give you dates better, as I say, at another time, but the next move was to get me to Liège. And they couldn't get me out through Liège, but at least I could get something done myself, and that's when I first started getting involved in this terrorist group. And the chap that took me on the train was still alive, and I had forgotten his name, and I only knew him for an hour. So I didn't remember him too well, but he remembered me so well that when he got wind of my trip this summer, that he wanted to get together again, which we did. We went up and visited him for an hour or so, and we went through the whole thing. And the man he turned me over to was a relative of his who's since died. I remembered him, but I didn't remember this fellow until I saw him. As soon as I saw him, I remembered him. It's remarkable.
What I'm picking up a little bit from what you're saying is a lot of these people were actually relatives, cousins, you know, the people who were working together on this escape plan or this escape route were, or a number of them were related. What I really want to ask is, did a lot of these people know each other before the war so that they used their pre-war kind of connection to networks?
Oh, there's bound to be a tremendous amount of that, but no, it was a little, the people I was with at this particular time were just sideline people. And they were, they say, sure, we'll take him in. They're not involved actively in the resistance movement, but the resistance say, okay, we know these people are safe. We've got to put this guy somewhere, and we've got to do it today, in an hour. And these people responded.
And that's all they would do?
That's all their involvement was, to my knowledge. I don't think, well, I think Willie would have mentioned something to me. I've met him twice after the war, and he would have said, if there'd been an involvement there. And I don't think there was, although he was picked up and had a pretty stiff grueling by the Gestapo, which, you know, they stick people's heads in pails of ammonia. And if you're fair-skinned like Willie was, it took him months and months to get over that. And I'm not talking about the stuff you wash windows with. That's sissy stuff. Boy. Anyhow, no, these people were mostly friends of the resistance. And that's how it was that I knew that immediate family and their immediate best friends. That didn't happen anywhere else in the whole time I was in there, that one particular family. And it was with the and two close family groups. And Albert Dumoulin was the husband of their one family group. The other one was more or less headed by the widow, the old lady, Madame Bolpa, that I saw in 60, who subsequently died that summer. Those two families were very close. And it was with Albert's widow and one of the Bulpa sisters that I, who are old ladies now and have an apartment between them, that where we stayed this summer. So that, but their involvement in the resistance beyond me as an individual in this instance, I say I think that's it.
Okay, that's yeah. That answers it.
So when I get to Liège, I was taken to Herstal. That's north of Liège. It's a mining area as well as the Fabrique Nationale, which most people know of as the NATO gunsmith for their late Brownings. And, of course, the factory belonging to Lucien Dupré, who made piston rings for the German army, and headed up his own little three-ring circus. And the things he did, we had to know sooner or later he'd get it. He was not security conscious. It was a very rough-edged, hairy operation. I've known that guy go out after supper and see if he couldn't dispatch a jury soldier, if he could find one on the street in the dark, in the winter, who... Actually, not so much soldiers. They didn't lean into that too much. They were more concerned with Rexists, as they called them. These are the Belgian collaborators, the Quislings of Belgium. And to dispose of one of them didn't invoke the ire of the Germans, because what grounds have they got, really? So this was really what Lucien's group was concerned with in one phase, but it was all on that level. There were lots of arms kicking around. As a matter of fact, that was one of my jobs with them, was as armorer for the group. And I would rebuild pistols or any firearm that we could get our hands on, and the word goes out. If you've got a weapon that you've been hiding since the outbreak of hostilities, go and dig it up or find it or whatever and bring it to us so that we can recondition it and put it back on the line again. Well, some people, in their haste, just buried them in the dirt. Well, you just a lump of rust. But some of them were very, very careful, oiled them, packed them in grease, wrapped them up in oil cloth and buried them in the garden. Some of them, different ways of hiding them, and some of them came back, were in absolutely flawless condition. Some had to be repaired, and every possible make of weapon you could imagine. And one in particular that fascinated me was a German officer's automatic pistol, probably one of the very earliest ones that was officer issue in the Franco-Prussian War. And the dates were all on it, the whole thing. And it was only through talking to other people there, older Belgians that were into the scene that knew about this stuff. But the German civilian pistol, the German, I shouldn't say that, European generally, 9mm things like cannons with great pearl handles on them and silver engraved barrels. And we're used to seeing over on this side automatic weapons with a spring return below the barrel, whereas these, a lot of Fabrique Nationale, but some other weapons, Mausers, Lugers, First World War, all have different return mechanisms. And the one that fascinated me was the Fabrique Nationale had the spring around the barrel, so the barrel looked quite large, but there was no lower part to it. It never appealed to me very much, but it fascinated me the way they put it together. And I, the one that I spoke of that was a Franco-Prussian one, it took me the longest time to get that disassembled. I couldn't find the key. And I'd play around with it and put it to one side and do some more, and then I'd come back to it. When I did discover it, it was a way in which the front sight was depressed that unlocked it. And, of course, I wasn't expecting this. I was messing around, and the springs went in all directions. I got her back together, but I enjoyed that because I'm a mechanic by nature anyway. I like things like that. But this was the type of operation Lucien ran, and his security was limp, just terrible. And he'd undertake anything. He didn't care whether the people he's involved with were so sloppy security risks that they could have carried the whole Gestapo in there. And I suppose this is what eventually did happen. But to give you a good example of the way he operated, Dr. Appeldorn, whom I had mentioned, but is only remotely connected, had a 1937 Ford sedan, American one. Oh, very, very fancy. And he gave it to the resistance and just listed it, you know, and went to the cops and said, somebody made off with my car. So that cleaned it up as far as he was concerned, and then they just hit it and used it when they needed it. And a fellow by the name of John and another pal of his, Paul, it doesn't matter, probably weren't the right names anyway, used to, when the occasion required, and I remember this particular instance, they had a Rexist who was very active, and he was a real bad actor. He didn't care how far he went. And I guess Jerry made sure that he was thoroughly petrified. Once he got in that deep, he had to go along with him, to the point where Jerry gave him bodyguard. Well, he came out of the Gestapo headquarters one day, and these guys, it was around, must have been lunchtime or something, where they could pinpoint him for time. They were waiting for him. And they used to, I think, spend all their time watching Edward G. Robinson movies, Little Caesar and that, because that's just the way they behaved. But they, after this is all over, John described how they did it. He said, well, Paul drives, and he said, I jump out of the back seat because the way the door opens, it's better. Because the door's hinged at each end and opened so that he's opening a suicide door in the back seat. He's got the door behind him instead of having to walk around it. They pull up just in front of this guy. He stepped out of that door, put a complete clip into this guy in the middle. These two Jerrys are so stunned they don't know what's hit them, and which is normal. They counted on that. And he's back into the car again, and they're gone. And by the time they're around the corner, and forget it. It was an identifiable car, it's true, but you had to get them right away because they'd go into hiding with it. They had garages stashed all over the place where they could hide this thing. But this is the way they operate. Well, you can't keep this up indefinitely without coming unstuck. And that guy, incidentally, it took him 2 days to die. And they were a little worried about this because this guy's bargaining all the time, too. And the Jerry said, well, we can't operate on you until we find these things out in case you don't survive the operation and all this kind of stuff. So they, you know, everybody was very cute with one another. And anyhow, that fella finally succumbed to 7 rounds. That's a lot. Not hit anything. And all of them went in. Anyhow, and there was a lot of that going on. When they gave me my first suit, well, the only suit I ever had, when I was in that windmill in the glass factory, probably the suit coat was way too big. Well, I didn't bother because, did I mention this before or not?
Yeah, we talked about this before. Lots of people wore suits that were too big for them because they were passed down.
The ones with the bullet holes in them?
Right, you mentioned
that. Yeah, oh, okay, then that's it. Anyway.
No, not on the tape. You haven't put it on the tape.
Oh, I see. Well, no, this is what I was saying, that it was a good quality suit they gave me, real hard-wearing stuff, and I'm sure some guy paid a lot of money for it peacetime. But there were 2 bullet holes in the front of the coat and about 4 in the vest, and all the back of the vest on the lining part, light-colored lining part, was all blood-stained. But you don't waste a suit of that quality. And it looked just about right for an ill-dressed civilian who's trying to make out the best he can. So that part of it worked out all right. But that's how those bullet holes occurred, is you get guys like John and Paul come up and I'm going to fix your suit for you. And they did. Anyway, I had 2 sessions of living in Herstal. The first time when I worked with Dupre as armorer and doing this sort of thing, it was there that I was told that there was a Mexican had been shot down, and he was staying up at the Peters, which is the Peters were the people that ran the local movie house. And I thought, a Mexican? That's unusual. Anyhow, we get up to visit them one evening and have supper there. And Madame Legrand spoke reasonably good English. Now, she lived across the street from Lucien Dupre, and she was where we were the night the Gestapo broke in. And she said, well, I'll take you up there. And it was a 10-minute hike up the main stem and go up to the movie theater and in a little house beside there is where they lived. And New Mexico was what she's talking about, because this is a tall, blonde guy. And I guess I must have appeared quite rude, but I hadn't talked to anybody on our side for 3 months or whatever length of time it was. And so this guy arrived on the scene, and we kind of ignored everybody else for a while until Madame Legrand said, you really should say how do you do to the host. excuse me. But anyway, had a beautiful dinner, rabbit with, I'd never had a roast rabbit before, and they have stewed plums, not prunes, plums to go with it. Quite unusual, most delightful, typical Belgian dish. And ice cream, very thin, very good. Because they had a little ice cream concession to go with the theater. You could get a few of these little things used to go in Belgium. You could get them. The rationing systems in the different countries varied, even though they were under German occupation. The French had very nice bread under the occupation. The Belgian bread was terrible. German bread was worse, if it's possible. Anyhow, it worked out that Harry came to live in the same house where I was with Lucien Dupre. We had a room right up in the garret, and there was a little cupboard. And in the cupboard was a fake pass, like the right guard ad, Mona. Well, that's how we were to get into the next house in the event of a raid. And it would be pretty hard to peg this because it was made in such a way that everything looked like it was old and dirty and had never been touched. And there were a couple of things on the shelves, but the shelf thing came out as a package. So we stayed up there, and various people passed through there from time to time. One was a 13-year-old French kid. He'd been taken to work in the factories somewhere in Germany, in the Ruhr probably, somewhere fairly close to the Belgian border. And he was the cheekiest little kid I ever saw. He didn't have any nerve at all. And the Germans walked patrol at night. They'd walk two by two in the middle of the road, not next to the doorways. And that was just the right distance for this little kid to hurl a whole thunder mug at these guys. Well, of course, we didn't think much of that because we don't need to draw attention to ourselves, but I guess that could happen in any house in Belgium in those days. That maybe that's one reason they walked out in the middle of the road. They got more than one thunder mug dumped on them.